Thank you, Andy. This is a difficult one, given what's been going on for the last 2 hours. And in many ways, some of the themes that or descriptions of projects and cities that I wanted to use to provoke a discussion, I've set aside and want to just be very brief and continue, in a way, the provocation about the relationship between social practice, social control, and design and built form. This is an image that many of you in the room may know. It's a bench next to a bus stop in downtown LA. And it's designed in such a way that if you lie on it, you fall off. And it's the client for this is the LA Police Department. And it's designed to make sure that the people in this part of LA do not sleep next to the bus stops late at night. And the issue, why I'm using this image and why, in a way, obviously I'm provoked by the earlier discussion to use it, is to just, in a way, amplify Richard's point about the relationship between the physical space we create, that we have a choice to create as designers and urbanists and policymakers, and the implications that they have. But perhaps more importantly, and this particularly to Professor Zheng Qiling, I want to take further the point that the discussion we were having before, particularly also to reflect on the fact of who's it for and what the brief is in the wider sense of the word. Because if you could say that this is a highly successful project, it has been designed to make sure that people fall off. It's fine if you sit on it for 5 minutes. It's absolutely not fine if you want to sleep there all night. So in that sense, that's probably the only thing I would really want to say. And how do we amplify that concept when it comes to designing cities and designing housing and urban neighborhoods? Is there a dimension of this which lies behind, you know, these vast scale analytical plans that we produce, trying to understand cities in their regions? Is there something about design and physical space behind this, which is the density maps that we've talked a lot so much? Because really, you know, if we look at the density, we've heard these figures and they are staggering. And just look at this comparison. In red is very, very high density, the density you see around us. That's Shanghai. In Manhattan, one only achieves it more or less in parts of the center around on both sides of Central Park and downtown. In London, it looks as if nobody's there. It's quite interesting if you just make this comparison. Now, I'm not interested in the density figures. What I'm interested in, what does this look like? What does it feel like? What is the sort of space that is determined around? And I want to raise a number of questions behind that. We've, in fact, with Bruno Moser, who is modestly sitting there and pushing buttons, actually done some extremely interesting research over the last year at the London School of Economics with other colleagues. We've been looking at the micro scale of how buildings are designed from the inside out to create space that works. This is not for a moment a suggestion that this is the way to do it here or anyone else. It's just trying to get to grips with what those rules are, which actually constitute form, constitute urban form, which I think in response to the issues raised before can at least do two things. One is actually create a form of space which works for all. Now, I know that sounds terribly New Labour and Tony Blairish, but I don't mean it in that way. It's trying to connect to the point that we made earlier. How does one actually create an urban structure which can be inhabited by differences and by different constituencies? And I think that is an issue worth pursuing and discussing in this debate. And here we have three different models. It's different parts of Berlin, different parts of New York, and different parts of London. And they are completely different typologies. I'm not going to attempt to describe them. What they do is work well at two levels, I think. One is in terms of inhabiting resilience. And here I link Richard Sennett to Frank Duffy's point yesterday about how different organizations or different social structures need an infrastructure of resilience to actually inhabit places in different ways. Society changes, buildings remain the same. I referred to this building. It's a perfect example of from a flower factory to a conference center. Who knows what it will be like in 5, 10 years' time? Those are the issues that I think are relevant there. The second one is time, and I think it was alluded to many times in this conference and is very much sort of one of the leitmotifs of the one of the issues that we are addressing. What I'm interested in, therefore, is when we look at cities, when we talk about it, as we will in a moment with two more presentations, it's not the fact that, yes, there's this vast scale and pace of change, and here is a builder, and what's it like down there? What does it feel like walking around there? Is there a choice that we could make as designers and as policymakers, which maybe reproduces some of the positive qualities of some of the images we saw earlier this morning, without losing the notion of progress, which is such a critical issue here. And I think time is an important element because, you know, that's what happened in this city in 200 years. This is what happened in London in 1,000 years. Right? But here you're doing it in 10 years. And what is important when you see this pace of change from Roman London to 20th century London, 21st century London, is that in the middle of this urban mess, urban sprawl of London, which it is, there are some very clear pieces of, I think, very well planned architecture, which is actually all private sector development. And this, again, is not a model to say that Shanghai or anywhere else needs to be planned like this. What is interesting here is that there's a model which is both private sector-led, these are all private estates still today, 200 years, in some cases 150 years after they were built. That's why, by the way, all these buildings look so wonderfully white. They're owned by one agency, which happens to be called the Crown Estate, and they determine what color and at what time every 5 years it has to be painted white. It also has a series of parks, inverted commas. They have gates around them. Only in some parts of London those gates were removed, and it's public space. We're still going through this sort of process of social change, but the spatial structure, and that probably is the key point I want to make, is something which has proven resilient to this change over a period of 100, 150 years. This one hasn't. It was like that in the 70s, it's like that now. So the question of how to actually intervene like a surgeon in the DNA of a city is an issue that is worth questioning. And in that sense, the four or five key questions to address for me in terms of the urban age as a series of investigations is, can one design, following on, I guess, from Richard's key point, buildings and public spaces that have the resilience to accommodate change, that it's not a one-to-one correlation between the two? And this is not just a question of monofunctionality, it's a question of typology, as Frank talked about in offices. I'm interested in whether housing itself has the same sort of restrictions and limits the possibility for absorbing different cultures, different levels of social engagement from different constituents in the city. I think it's very important to begin to understand the fact of whether you can design a piece of city which over time achieves greater complexity. And I think that is where we have all found it very, very difficult as architects and urban designers and as critics. Whether to create the first two, you need to actually create continuity ingrained in the fabric, like these three cities. There's London, Paris, Barcelona, Manhattan. Four completely different models, but if you half close your eyes, it looks all the same. These are periods of history which have accumulated over at least 300 or 400 years at least. So I'm, in a way, postulating an issue is whether the infrastructure that one creates not only provides a sort of possibility of cultural infrastructure, or as Mark called it before, well, the cultural infrastructure is the people, but how do they plug onto, how do they actually work with the grain that one has provided? And is there a potential for retrofitting when society changes as it does very drastically? In London, the key issue at the moment, we have a housing stock which covers the whole of the city, which is designed with two or three story terraced houses for families with four children. The 800,000 people moving into London is basically single families. So how do you use the housing stock for the new populations? And that is something which clearly is to be addressed here. And finally, Andy, this returns very much to your introduction, to the points you made yesterday. Given all these, what is the role of planning? And frankly, the interesting thing of the city that I live in and know is that none of the good things that have happened there for the last 20 years, Tony, were ever planned. There isn't one drawing of anything which is interesting, which has happened in London, which was planned in advance. Thanks very much.